Is that visible in the back there? Can you see that? It'll get a little lighter as it goes on. After we get to the first two slides, then we'll see. If it's too dark, we'll adjust the lighting. Okay, so what I thought I'd do is give you a little introduction to some of the causal structure issues which arise in the case of quantum fields in curved space, and then talk about quantum fields in curved space. So the first lecture will be on the causal structure. And what it is, it's a quick tour of classical relativity. Now, really important things about local and global structure of space-time that you may not have seen in your past training in relativity are some of the topics that will be covered in these lectures. And these issues are the ones which are important for actually doing field theory in these cases. In these talks, the conventions I'll choose are that the speed of light and the gravitational constant, coupling constant, is set to 1, and that it actually has a signature of minus with all pluses in the spatial dimensions. And this can be in any dimension. Okay, is that, everyone can see that in the back now? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so we'll start off from the basics. It's sort of like taking your, I remember when I was in elementary school or that, you'd always have the same review of set theory every year. And so that's how we're going to sort of start here. We'll have a little review of what a space-time is. And some of these issues are actually relevant for doing the global, the issues in field theory. Because typically when you write down the metric, it's a local quantity, and it's the global issues that are actually going to be important for the field theory and other calculations. So let me just review a bit of this. This may be a review for some. We'll come back and point out some of the little sticky points, and that'll be one of the other aspects we'll do on the field theory. I'll go back and look at where some of the ideas from flat space, Minkowski space, actually break down. So just to sort of have some common language, space-time, we'll take it as a mathematician, what it's an ordered pair, where you have a manifold here, it's smooth n-manifold, and G is actually your symmetric non-degenerate tensor with this signature, so it's your Lorentzian metric on this background. And we'll actually use this formal definition because in some of the examples you'll see in the next few lectures, some of these issues are actually going to occur. So we're going to have every point, here's our manifold, it's some sort of has an idea of a topology, what it means for points to be close nearby. And what we do is we cover it with a collection of sets U alphas and U beta here as one set in this collection. The set of open sets and mappings into Rn, which are homeomorphisms. So they're one-to-one and onto. So locally, this space looks like Rn. They map down into Rn here, the same dimension for each point. And then what happens in the overlap region where you get an intersection, you get some region, this overlap here for this U alpha and the corresponding phi alpha would go to this set, and for U beta would actually go to this set. And then what you're requiring is you know what it means to be differentiable on Rn, and so this is really your condition. Now, I said we're going to do a smooth manifold, so that would mean just an infinite number of derivatives. And you can also do analytic, for example, which will become very relevant for the Euclidean field theory approach to quantum fields in curved space. And you can also weaken this down to maybe one or two continuous derivatives. So this is totally arbitrary. If this is only continuous, then this doesn't really give you any new information. And it's equivalent to saying each point is just homeomorphic or continuously equivalent to Rn. So this is sort of the picture you have in mind. Now, why do we worry about smooth manifolds? Okay, and as I repeated several times, you want to do field theory, you're going to have to consider global structure. Point two is local knowledge of the metric does not determine the global structure of space-time. So it's very similar. And another issue I'd like to point out, and I'll show you some example in the last lecture, global structure includes differentiable structure, not just topology. So if you are coming from quantum fields in curved space as a string theorist, you may read some of the old literature. You're talking about Hawking Page, phase transitions, so forth, the Euclidean quantum gravity. And typically in that literature, it was always said that, well, it's the topology which we represent by an Euler characteristic and signature if you're doing four-dimensional topology, four-dimensional fluctuations, and the metric. And you can write down examples where that's not true. So you really have to go back here and really be concerned about this differentiable structure in some cases, especially working in higher dimensions. In fact, we have some examples that have been published in the last few years where you actually have solutions to the Einstein equations, and this actually matters. So this is one of the reasons for concern. So doing field theory on these backgrounds, you'll have the same concern. Now, we're going to put some extra topological conditions on this. Originally, we just said it's going to look like Rn. And what we really want to do is we want to do physics, and so we need to define what we mean by an action. We want to know what volume is, what the fields. So the smooth structure will allow us to find derivatives, but to define the volume, we need some sort of way of defining a volume. If you think of the room here as being a manifold by that definition, just R3, then you can stack cubes up and measure the volume of each cube, and that would give you a sensible definition of volume, and you could go, we already know this is, looks pretty much like Minkowski space, at least what we see, so we sort of know how to define an action. And so you want to continue that idea across. If the room were compact, like a sphere, you could cover it with two charts and do a comparison of the area of each hemisphere and calculate that way just using Rn. But in a room or in space where it actually has infinite extent, you want to extend this. And so paracompact sort of captures that. All that means is you can sort of find a sort of countable set of charts. They're only finite. And that you can define a function on there which will go to zero except on the finite number of these. This allows you to extend this idea of just adding up the volume in the room or some Euclidean space. And so this seems like a rather technical condition. It is, but we'll, in a moment or two, we'll have a much nicer condition to replace that. And what you can show is any differentiable N-manifold which admits a Lorentzian metric. So that's something you want to do for considering relativity or causal structure or quantum fields in curved space. Will actually automatically be paracompact. Now, there's one other extra condition that's sort of a slightly sticking point. We'll talk about this with, for example, the Taub-Nut instanton. And that is we put this Hausdorff condition, which, if you remember your point set topology from someplace in the past, points, what it means is if you have your space, which in our case is the manifold, if you pick two points, you can isolate those points with open sets. So you take the interiors of these, and clearly this little section here in the screen, you can separate this. So this is a separation condition. Turns out, in the case of the Taub-Nut solution, there's extensions there which satisfy this. Obviously, otherwise it's not a solution. But if you violate this condition, the space is no longer singular. So the singularity in those Taub-Nut instantons and Lorentzian metrics is actually coming from violations of this condition. So these actually occur in sort of solutions that have been known for 40 years. So this is why it's not necessary and sufficient here, but for our purposes, we'll assume both. And so when I talk in later lectures about these solutions, I'll bring up this point. So the main motivation for this condition is you can show a little result here which tells you what's equivalent. So instead of having the nasty Hausdorff paracompact, which are very sort of technical conditions, you can replace this with some other equivalent conditions. And one of the conditions, all these four statements here are all the same. They're all equivalent. And one condition you can say is the topology comes induced from a metric. And by that, I mean the traditional view of a distance function defining what you mean by open sets, which is more relevant for the condition which is more relevant for doing Euclidean field theory is that there's some sort of Riemannian metric. So that's a positive definite metric, which if you take the length of the curves from that, it'll also give you the distance function, so it's a very easy map. And then you can put this added conditional Lorentzian. So these are all the equivalents. So typically, when you want to think about this, this is probably the easiest way. Condition 2 or 3 are the most convenient ways to think of it. So unless otherwise mentioned, when we come to these examples, we'll assume these equivalent statements. So let me just give you, this is a very technical example. What I will do is at some point I'll print all these notes off, and so if you want copies, you can have copies, and then also I'll make them available on the web. I just want to check all the little bugs in there, make sure I didn't have any typos. But if you just take an n-dimensional sphere, and you think of that as being a unit vectors in Rn plus 1, this is a set of charts. The reason for picking these charts is this will satisfy very simply our conditions, because what we're going to do is we'll just think of this n plus 1 tuple of numbers, and we'll delete one coordinate. And so clearly, if I delete a coordinate, it's just a projection, that's a very nice smooth map. And so there's some sort of smoothness. And the inverse can also be written down in terms of radicals or square roots here. And so these compositions will be smooth. And so this will give us a nice smooth structure on the sphere. So this is one choice of a chart. The charts are the U's and the Phi's. And the collection of all those, each one is called a chart, and the collection of all those is an atlas. And so this is the actual explicit construction. You don't have to, you know, follow through everything here. But this shows you can really do this. Much simpler picture is what everyone usually thinks of. So we have a nice stereographic projection here. What I have is I have a picture of a sphere, and this works in n dimensions. So you can take it, this is the subspace in n plus one dimensions. So in the particular case that's drawn here, we have our plane sitting in R3, and then I set a sphere on it and I do the stereographic projection. This gives me a chart in the sense I can map the North Pole, put a rod through here, or axis, and this is the pivot point, and so this point gets mapped here. And I can do this for all the points except the North Pole itself. So that'll give me a local coordinatization, and the additional one you can take is at the South Pole, put a plane over here, and then just a bit of vector algebra and work will actually show you that this is two charts which cover it, and it gives you a nice smooth collection of charts on here. Now, the question is, if you go back to these two, here's the more complicated one. This, the algebra is much easier on. That's why one traditionally does that one. This one, it's very easy to geometrically visualize. In most cases, this may be enough. So when you're considering space-times, if you have a simple visualization of it, that might be more convenient in doing a field theory calculation or trying to decide a global aspect of your space-time. So what you need is you need some sort of equivalence. You need to decide, are those two equivalent? And this is one of the relevant points that will actually come up in field theory on these backgrounds. So what we'll have is you have a manifold, your two manifolds here, and they don't need to be the same dimension. We'll first define what we mean by something to be smooth. What we do is we have a continuous mapping between these two. And then what we ask is that when we change coordinates or change the different charts, that this be a smooth map, again, from Rm to Rn. So what we're doing is we're breaking everything down back into maps where we can just apply advanced calculus. And we'll additionally have the condition, if you have a homeomorphism, so in other words, an invertible map with an invertible inverse, and again, that's one-to-one, onto map, it's continuous. And if it has a smooth inverse, and it's smooth itself, then we call that a diffeomorphism. And two manifolds which are diffeomorphic will be considered equivalent. So if you go back, just as a simple example of the sphere, you can think of this as just the equation x squared, y squared plus z squared equals 1. But another way to think of it is you could just think of it as all the rays pointing out of the origin, and each ray is one of those points, but just centering everything here. That's another coordinatization, and both those manifolds are diffeomorphic. It's just a different representation of it. So here's another example to just make you think a little bit about the differentiable structure and how these issues might be affected. So we don't have a geometry on here yet. We haven't defined what we mean by, or we haven't defined a metric yet. But here, what I take as my topological space is I just take the real numbers. And I take that to be the whole space, and so I have one open set to cover that. And then as my mapping, I take x to the 1/3. And I can take the cube root of negative numbers, so that's actually a nice one-to-one mapping. And that, with the real numbers themselves, forms a single chart. And so, just to point out, this is actually a nice smooth atlas now, because if you go back all the way to our definition here, over here, this only has to be differentiable when you put the condition in that you have more than one chart. So we only have one chart here, so by default it's actually a nice smooth structure on the real numbers. And just to sort of show you how the structure may vary when you look at a metric or that something in local coordinates, this function here, x to the 2/3, is a nice smooth function in that chart. Because when you compose it, using the previous definition, you just get x squared. And as a map from R to R, x squared is smooth. So this is not what you traditionally think of as a smooth function on R, but by my choice of coordinates, that is. And so this is one of the other aspects you can will encounter. So now this is also our diffeomorphism, so this is diffeomorphic to the usual R. And so the definition of the differentiable functions, you have to remember, may change depending on how you coordinatize your space or you pick your atlas. And again, this will be important for doing global issues. So here's a little homework. If you know all this and you want to play with something while I finish this up, you can also think about it for the next lecture. And prove or disprove, so you can sort of see how these things work, is given a connected manifold M, dimension N here, and a point P in M, then you want to prove or disprove that M minus a point is not diffeomorphic to M. So is that generically true, or is it special? You know, are there counterexamples? And here's an example showing you that it is true in one particular case, and it's the example we had. And that is, you just take the n-sphere minus a point, and we know that's Rn, because we just pulled the north pole out. We just saw that from our stereographic projection. And clearly Rn and Sn are not the same space. One is compact and the other is open. So we know they're not diffeomorphic, so this maybe is provable, but the question is that generally true? And so this will give you some nice examples if you think about this, and I'll give you the answer in some future thing. Now, we also encountered, when talking about smooth structures, this example where the smooth functions on R with the one coordinate system compared to the other coordinate system, that this funny behavior, the x to the 2/3, was actually a nice smooth function now. So the question is, can you actually get exotic differentiable structures, or are these structures, by exotic, we mean, are they unique? And a classic result, which has been known for 40 years, is that in three or less dimensions, the differentiable structures are actually unique, and all manifolds admit a differentiable structure. So you can always put smooth coordinates on. And this will actually be important when looking at higher dimensional space-times. In four or more dimensions, the differentiable structures are not unique. And sort of the most famous example of 20 years ago, the most famous example, of course, was the seven-dimensional sphere. If you had a seven-dimensional sphere, Milner showed in the 1950s that it actually had 28 different differentiable structures. However, some work of Michael Friedman and Simon Donaldson actually showed that R4 itself has different differentiable structures. In fact, that's the only dimension that can happen in. And so people like Peter Freund were going around saying, well, that's a nice reason why, you know, you get four-dimensional space-times is because of this property here. And so it's sort of an interesting thing. In fact, what happens in four dimensions is R4 can have an uncountably infinite number of different differentiable structures. So Rn always has to have a unique differentiable structure except in four dimensions. And in any dimension bigger than four or more, you always have manifolds with non-unique structures. So when you consider a space-time in a metric, you have to be considering the smooth structure along with it. And you can construct geometries in that on some of these examples. So in five more dimensions, it's not really relevant exactly what we're talking about. If you try discretizing, you try doing sort of a Reggie calculus, some sort of decomposition in terms of discrete methods, then piecewise linear things actually become important, and it turns out there's non-unique smoothings of triangulations in five or more dimensions, and there's some very pathological examples there. The other thing that happens in four dimensions or more is you can find a particular manifold, and this is why R4 doesn't have an exotic or a unique differentiable structure. You can find a manifold which is called E8, which is built off the Dinkin diagram for the exceptional Lie group, E8. And its quadratic form, which classifies it, actually tells you can't have a smooth structure on that manifold. So that manifold is never smoothable. There's no smooth structure on that. So you can define local charts, and each piece will sort of be smooth, but there's no way to piece this together. Physical importance, I mentioned sort of some recent work in classical and quantum gravity, and there's preprint just coming out, where you actually solve the Einstein equations. You can show that the Riemannian and Lorentzian, there's Euclidean and Lorentzian solutions with exotic differentiable structures, and they're actually Einstein metrics. And in higher dimensions, some of these look like cosmological solutions. And so these structures actually become important. And there's other work on piecewise linear case and doing sums over sort of doing quantum gravity type calculations, which you can also apply to other discretized gravity theories. Okay, so now, That's enough about the differentiable structure. So the main lesson to think of here is when we write down a space-time, we should be careful that we can do a lot of our calculations locally, but when we start talking about global issues, we may have to be concerned about that differentiable structure. So a little bit of review. We'll assume everybody knows geometry or basic tensor calculus, sort of basic relativity on a Lorentzian background. And so we'll use del here as our covariant derivative. And the del we're using in these particular lectures is the one which is compatible with the metric. So this is determined by the metric. The curvature convention, again, the signature convention was one negative eigenvalue, and the rest of the spatial eigenvalues are actually positive. The advantage of that, of course, is that gives you, on spatial slices, that gives you nice Riemannian geometry. Otherwise, you have to carry minuses around, and it's just nicer to avoid that. The curvature convention here is, we use the curvature here to actually measure the Riemann curvature measures the anti-commuting of the covariant derivative when acting on a vector field. So this is some arbitrary vector field, and when you take it, the anti-symmetrized, so this is anti-symmetrized with a factor of a half in it. So that's where this extra half comes from here. And so that sets my Riemann curvature condition, which will be relevant. And this gives us the Riemann curvature. Geodesics are just given by the geodesic equation, where this is our unit vector, tangent vector. And all of these three definitions will be the same ones used when we do Euclidean field theory in the Euclidean calculations. And we'll just replace our metric there by the appropriate Riemannian one. Let me just warn you, if you're starting out, if you have to do calculations, don't ever calculate curvature in terms of g. Always use Cartan calculus. I'll give you some examples, where I can do the calculations very quickly in the future in these lectures. And Cartan calculus is just extremely fast and easy compared to the Riemann, just grinding away the Christoffel symbols. So in Lorentzian geometry, we have basically three types of geodesics. We have null geodesics, which are the ones which massless particles you can think of traveling on. And we have our time-like geodesics. And these are the ones which, in our signature convention, will give us a negative norm. And then we have our space-like geodesics. And you don't only divide your geodesics, but you can also divide your curves into the same types of classes. And just as a note, we all know Riemannian geometry will only have one type. This will become relevant when we do the Euclideanizations for field theory calculations. What will happen is the black hole horizon that will sort of disappear or won't be in the space-time or the Riemannian continuation because of losing these types of different geodesics. Okay, now a couple other things we need to talk about here is we want to talk about symmetries. In doing quantum fields in curved space, what you find out is most of the cases you can calculate have symmetries. It turns out that all the metrics you can write down sort of form a set of measure zero if you're technically correct about space times. The ones you can't write down in closed form, those are like the larger sets. So it's the simple idea, like when you think of a continuous function, set of all continuous functions, the ones which are differentiable have one derivative or sets of measure zero. Same kind of thing. So the metrics you can write down, the reason you can write them down is they have killing vectors or symmetries. So we want to review a little bit about what the symmetries are in the case of space-times. So what we need is we need a definition of physical equivalence. And space-time, this first space-time will be equivalent physically to the second one if there's a diffeomorphism between them such that the one metric maps into the other. And if you want to think of this, you can think of this locally. This is just the coordinate change on the coordinates. You can formally define it globally as pullbacks of maps. But we're assuming you know this, and so this is just bringing the one metric to the other. The mapping goes this way because this is a covariant tensor, remember, it pulls back the metric the opposite way. It's the up and down indices. Now, this is different than an isometry. So physical equivalence are basically two things which are equivalent. This is, in string theory, you know this from reparametrization invariance of the world sheet, and in its equivalent quantity in just ordinary field theory, is these are the gauge transformations of your theory. So this, all the physical invariances are in these diffeomorphisms. Now we also have isometries, which are a special class, and these are what really give us the symmetries. And an isometry is basically a diffeomorphism of the space-time to itself that fixes the metric. And so a simple example is if you just take Minkowski flat space, just take the flat metric dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, translations will actually map that exactly back into itself. But if you send one of the coordinates to a coordinate squared, then that falls into this class, but that's not isometry of the metric. So that physically changing the coordinates doesn't do any difference, but the symmetry is captured in the fact that the metric returns to its same form. And one other useful isometry is actually the conformal isometry, which is almost the same, except we have a conformal rescaling of the metric under this. And what I'll try to show you in some of the other examples where we have explicit ones, using these properties combined with the killing and conformal killing vectors actually gives you they're simple tools for calculating what the symmetries are of a given space-time. So now these guys, these are the infinitesimal versions of what we mean by isometries and conformal isometries. And so I'll start with the conformal killing vector, which is the more general case. And once we know that, we can get the killing vector from that. And so the equation which we obey when we have a conformal killing vector is, I'm going to write it in this form. The alternate way to say this is when the diffeomorphism generated by this vector field, the flow generated by this, acts on the metric, it changes the metric by a scale. So that's the infinitesimal statement of this. If I use that Lie derivative, which is the physicist's infinitesimal version, then I get this differential equation. And the advantage of this is a lot easier to solve in the cases where you actually have some metric written down. Now, the special case you have are your isometries. So the way to think of the conformal killing vector, they generate the infinitesimal conformal transformations or isometries, and the killing vectors are the isometries themselves. So these are divergence-free, killing vectors are divergence-free conformal killing vectors. And this just means you're preserving the volume, that divergence-free, it's a standard interpretation. Now, how to find conformal killing vectors and killing vectors. So there's a very simple, some simple tricks you can use. If you have two conformally equivalent metrics, they have the same conformal killing vectors. So if one metric's a multiple of the other, then you can actually simply figure out they have the same conformal killing vectors. If you want to find out the killing vectors, the idea is you find the conformal killing vectors first and then find out which combinations actually give you which are divergence-free. Now, the other thing you can do through a counting argument is you can show the number of these, the generators of this, is always finite. It's always a finite number of these. And so you can explicitly write them down. The other thing you can show is there's a maximum number. The maximum number is realized by some canonical solutions, such as de Sitter or Minkowski. And so you're never going to have more than that. And so those simple little tricks will actually allow one to calculate these quantities. In field theory, these will actually be symmetries, and so these will give you conserved quantities. So having these killing vectors is rather important for doing field theory calculations. There's another way to do it if you decide to build spaces from identifying one space by another. And the way you can do this is if you know a bit of basic group theory, you take the normalizer. GEO just stands for any geometric structure. So if you want to look at conformal killing vectors, you take the conformal killing vectors on the covering space. If you want to look at killing vectors, you take the killing vectors. If you want to look at things that preserve the connection, you can replace this. So this works for anything. And you just calculate the normalizer of the group that actually does the identifications, and you mod out. So this gives you very simple ways to calculate these. And I'll show you the example in de Sitter where you can do this. You can actually see how you lose symmetries by doing identifications. It also changes the quantum field theory substantially by doing this. Now, one other tool that's useful is formally defined the Riemann curvature, but we can also break the Riemann curvature up into its different pieces, and this comes from basically several different methods. You can just break it in terms of the symmetries. You can take the traceless part out. This is the Weyl curvature, or you can also break it in terms of using group representation theory, but this is your Weyl tensor, and so this is the conformally invariant part of the Riemann curvature. The other parts come from the Ricci curvature, which is a trace. And then this additional piece, which is the difference. Again, my little brackets here, you just anti-symmetrize on those indices, and everything has the 1 over the number of indices factorial. So there's a half always in these. And if n equals 2 here, you see this term has some problems. And what happens in n equals 2 is basically the whole Riemann curvature is really determined by the scalar. N equals 3, this guy's also 0 in 3. And so again, what's going to happen there, everything will be determined by Ricci. So once you get the four dimensions, you actually have this vial part of the curvature. Now, physicists, the standard way you think of the vial in relativity is a vial curvature is like the gravitational radiation, is one interpretation. If you break the theory in term, break it up in terms of spinner decomposition, these are the basically the sort of degrees of propagating degrees of freedom. Now, another way to think of it is if you think of the Schwarzschild solution, which most people have seen in the past, your black hole solution, then that actually has the vanishing Ricci, but clearly it's not flat space, so it tells you this is not vanishing gravitational radiation, but it's still those extra gravitational degrees of freedom you have in going to the higher dimensions. One additional property you can have of the vial curvature, it vanishes if and only if the metric's locally conformally flat. Now I say locally here because it's only a local condition. That is, there's not a global conformal factor that actually gives you this condition. So a canonical example, you can go back to two-dimensional Riemann surfaces, and there they're all locally conformally flat, but there's different global conformal factors depending on the Euler characteristic. Here's a little homework if you want to practice the killing vectors. You can try, we'll have these three metrics at some point in the lecture. There's the Rindler-Riemann and the sitter, and these are actually, these two are going to be very similar, but these are very symmetrical spaces, and you can try out your techniques on calculating the killing vectors for these guys. And so finally, we're to the space-time equations here, and I've just written down the Einstein equations in this standard form. This is usually grouped as the Einstein tensor. The half here doesn't have anything to do with dimension. It comes from the variation in the Hilbert action, and this is your cosmological constant. This term represents the stress energy tensor, which will be one of the objects we spend a lot of time discussing with the quantum fields in curved space. Now, typically, when you do this classically, what you're doing is you impose some sort of energy conditions on the T here. So an anic condition, some average null, a weak, a strong or dominant condition. So what you're really saying there is that there's some local causality, that you don't have faster than light travel locally in neighborhoods of points, local observers, or that you don't have negative energy violations coming from your matter fields. A lot of the theorems proven about black holes and that will actually still go through even with this cosmological constant term. So if you have negative energy coming from a cosmological constant, usually doesn't break the theorems. What breaks it is if it appears in here, and typically any of the theorems that are broken on black holes and so forth, usually what you find is the matter source here is unphysical. In fact, if this comes from a there's different calculations done that no one's been able to really produce the violations from quantum corrections that are taken into account everything. So it's a little, this is very physical to have some sort of energy condition. The other thing, again, as I emphasized with the vial curvature, if we have no sources, Ricci 0 still gives you vial curvature, non-vanishing, so Riemann is really the vial, and you still can have all sorts of solutions which are not flat space. And just having a solution to this, you don't obey any sort of evolution equations. So when you do quantum fields in curved space, you actually need some notion of causality. You want to talk about your propagator, you want to evolve things. You're going to need that evolution idea. So it means that we probably don't want to consider the most general forms of solutions. We need to put some additional equations, conditions on. And so that brings us to the evolution equations and constraints. So we have to have some idea of what we mean to evolve a space-time or that. So just having a solution, again, you can have space-times which have no notion of evolution. We can build, I'll show you a couple examples shortly. So we want to do a Cauchy problem. Think of Cauchy problems in physics. You think of specifying a field and its derivative, and then you talk about its evolution. And this is even true in looking at the quantum fields in curved space. And so what we're going to do is it has to be a little more formal here because we have a general space-time. So what you'll find is this lecture we have a lot of formal definitions, but once we get through these definitions, we'll actually can apply them all to specific examples and also make some general statements. So Cauchy slicer surface is a space-like hypersurface. So that means if you look at the normal to the surface, it's a time-like vector. So the simple one to think of is T equal constant in Minkowski space. You can also think of De Sitter, if you've been thinking about De Sitter or anti-De Sitter. Well, anti-De Sitter is a little subtle, so we might not want to really mention that at this point. But if you think of De Sitter, again, a t-equal constant slice in the sort of global coordinates where it parameterizes the hyperboloid with expansion in the future and past, again, those are Cauchy slices. And so this is a curve that intersects once and only once. So every non-space-like curve, or what we call causal curve, will pass through that surface a unique, will always pass through, and it'll be a unique intersection. Globally hyperbolic space-time is just one which has got a Cauchy slice. So the reason for globally hyperbolic, it means you can do an evolution problem on your equations. Now, in addition, we'll be considering partial Cauchy slices. These are ones which are space-like hypersurfaces such that each causal curve intersects it at most once. And these are the standard examples. For example, Rindler space. When you consider Rindler space and you start getting particle creation or in De Sitter, what you find out is some of these effects are actually caused by not picking the Cauchy slice but picking a partial Cauchy slice. So the difference in those in the field behavior will actually be controlled by this. We'll have a shortly just have an example of a partial Cauchy slice in Minkowski, which is another slicing of it. And sort of the technical language which you want to say is the future domain of dependence, this is D plus S, is a set of all points in the space-time such that every past-directed, past-inexpendable causal curve intersects S. So in other words, what you're going to do is you're going to actually take all your curves and ask if they intersect. I'll show you an example. So the best, one of the things that happens with causal structure in these basics here is there's a lot of definitions, but once you start seeing the space-time diagrams, you can really grind through them very quickly and see what happens. The other advantage is, again, these techniques will work in general. So the past domain of dependence will always have past and future things. You just repeat the same thing with taking all future directed. And then a standard result is space-time is globally hyperbolic if and only if it's equal to the whole domain of dependence. So this slice actually picks sort of the whole future and past. It predicts everything. So this is the notion of evolution. Here's an example. And this one I mentioned already. If you just take Minkowski space with the standard Cartesian coordinates, and this is globally hyperbolic. Its Cauchy slice is just the t equals 0 slice. And you can actually go through the definition and check it works. No problem. Now, we can actually start doing some identifications on here. This is one way to produce things which are very different. And one identification we can do is we can send I noticed, I didn't know if there was some sort of ray gun or something, this little green light came on. Okay, so the other one you can do is Minkowski space with a periodic identification where T has some time translation in there. And that's not going to be globally hyperbolic because those curves are going to just wrap around that space and they're going to pass through that surface more than once. So that's not globally hyperbolic. And you can be fancy. You can take boosts and figure out which boosts work and do all sorts of things. But you can generate a bunch of globally hyperbolic, non-globally hyperbolic space-times. The other way you can produce non-globally hyperbolic space-times, you can go back to the Einstein equations and just plug in metrics and guess, you know, say, this is my favorite metric. That's going to be my matter source. And usually doing that gives you stuff which is not globally hyperbolic or causally well-behaved. So it's when you solve these equations and you use the physics that you get these well-behaved solutions. The other example which I want to show you is take the mass hyperboloid in Minkowski space. This is another example. And this shows you some of the ideas that this local metric in that you can get very different coordinatizations and local pieces of space-times, and they're going to be very different global structure. And so here is a canonical example. So you take the mass hyperboloid, and I chose the one which is directed to the past. You can pick the forward one, doesn't matter. And then here's the light cone. And then what I have here is this is the mass hyperboloid. So that should be a hyperboloid. And I'm going to take that to be my surface S. And now I'll ask, is that a Cauchy slice for this particular space-time? And the answer is no, because I've drawn a white line here. And remember, if this is a Cauchy slice, then every point in my space-time, so my space-time is this whole region here, all Minkowski space, so at any point here, if I trace a causal curve back, it has to intersect the surface. This white curve doesn't do that, so this is not a Cauchy slice. But this surface actually is partial Cauchy. It obeys the other condition, and that is each slice, each curve here will intersect it at most once. And so this is a partial Cauchy slice. And now what I can do is I can take a different point of view and say, well, if I think of the Einstein equations and I use them to evolve, I can evolve and ask what I get as my space-time. And if I solve the equations for vacuum, this is what I get. This metric here, this works in n dimensions, so this would be my n-dimensional metric. And n minus 1, this is my spatial dimensions, the dimensions of the hyperboloid. So the geometry on there will actually be a negatively curved space. And the evolution here will actually look like a collapsing universe. And this is actually another way to coordinatize a Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime. Now, if we look at this, we say, well, this is all silly because, wait a minute, you know, you can just extend this up and get the rest of the space-time. And the answer is, well, sure. However, if you do some identifications on the surface, you no longer can extend this into Minkowski space. And this actually does really collapse. That is, there actually is a physical crushing singularity in that space-time. So doing these identifications and looking at these partial Cauchy slices even classically gives you a very different behavior. Now, one of the things you can start thinking ahead of is, what if I do field theory, quantum field theory, on this surface instead of the t equals 0 slice? What's going to happen? And so this will be some of the issues here. Now, to actually do the evolution, if you want to go back to this and ask how the evolution goes, just for completeness, I've included what these equations are. And what these are just the constraint equations. So to solve the Einstein equations as an initial value problem, what you have to really do is it's a constrained system. And these equations are solved on your hypersurface, on your Cauchy slice. And this is the scalar curvature of the metric on that slice. And PAB is actually your velocity. If you think of it as a mechanical system or a field theory, this is your coordinate variable, the 3 metric. And you're holding time constant, so this is the rate of change of, or the velocity of this metric as a field theory. And so there's two constraints. This is the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, Gauss's law equivalent, and this is the Hamiltonian constraint coming from the time translations. This is the 0-0 component projecting the Einstein equations in the 0-0 direction, and this is in the 0 spatial direction. This is your momentum flow, and this is your energy density. So given any n minus 1 dimensional manifold with a Riemannian metric and such a tensor it satisfies, it will evolve into a globally hyperbolic space-time. I should mention one other thing here, which does follow from the definition, is if you have a globally hyperbolic space-time, this surface here is unique. It's smoothly unique. That is, since each curve has to pass through it once and only once, you can use that as a mapping to map any other Cauchy surface into that one. And that mapping will be diffeomorphic because a diffeomorphism because the curves are all smooth. And so that means the topology of the Cauchy slice, we don't want to really say topology, but the smooth manifold is always the same. It never changes. And so the evolution will look like R cross some manifold. And so the smooth structure in that case of the space-time is really fixed by the smooth structure of the hypersurface. So if you worked in 4 dimensions, you cannot produce an exotic solution of that in 4 dimensions from an evolution problem. Where they do occur in 4 dimensions is from tunneling calculations. And there's some basic existence results. You can show that any smooth manifold actually occurs as a solution. And you can also do things with de Sitter. You can produce locally de Sitter space-times. There's tons of results, but these are some of the stranger ones you get. You can actually show that every smooth manifold is a solution. That's been known for a while. But you can also show that you can solve the Einstein equations for locally de Sitter solutions. And I'll mention some of the causal structure stuff or the field theory when we give that as an example later. But these space-times had very different structure than de Sitter, but they locally look, if you lived in one, you'd think you were in de Sitter. But they're not from identifications of de Sitter. So you can get some very strange solutions. Okay, so now finally to the causal structure. So we now know what? We know what it means for space-time to be globally hyperbolic. That is, it's some evolution. It has this nice Cauchy slice. But we still haven't talked about what's a black hole, what are singularities. And so that's sort of the last little part of this causal structure review. And the first thing you need is a couple basic working definitions. And so what you look at is you look at the chronological future of a point. And of a point, all it is you take any point in your space-time, and the chronological future, Q is in the chronological future of P. If there's a future-directed time-like curve connecting the two. Okay, so what you're doing is you're only taking time-like. Our previous definition for the D, the domain of dependence for this Cauchy slice and the Cauchy slice, included all causal curves. So I only includes the time-like ones. And the reason for that is this gives you an open set. If you think of the light cone, what you're doing is you're actually just drawing your space-time or thinking your space-time. You're taking a local light cone in this. Okay, so this is an open set. And furthermore, given any set in your space-time, you can define the whole chronological future of that by just taking the union of all the points in there. This will be used in defining what we mean by a Cauchy horizon, event horizon, and black hole. So this is one of our base. That's why I didn't hand them out yet. Yeah, that should be an A. So we take all the P that are in the set A, and we just take the union of that. Thanks. And that, again, is open because regardless how big the set A is, this will actually still be an open set because the union of open sets is open. So that's our first thing. The chronological past, again, we'll always have these past future. We'll have black holes, white holes. They all occur by just replacing the future directed or past directed by the opposite guy. Now, we also have our causal future and our causal past. And what do you do there? You now include all causal curves. But by including the null curves are curves that could be time-like and null. So these aren't only geodesics in these sets. These are any curves. So you could have, for example, you could have something that accelerates and also, or something which is moving at the speed of light and then changes speeds. You could think of that physically as some sort of particle going from a massless, massive particle, some reaction, and depending which particles you track, you can get that. You can also think of it sending signals, radio signals from some source, that type of thing. So these are the causal future and past, and you just replace your time-like curves in the previous definition with the causal. So these guys are sort of the way to think of it is the interiors of these sets are the chronological ones. And the boundaries of these will actually be the null curves. And this little theorem here tells you that if you have a point, this is sort of taking the complement. So you remove all the guys that aren't, you take the causal curves and you remove all the ones which aren't in the chronological one. So you take out all the time-like curves. And then what happens is if you have any causal curve, that becomes a null geodesic. And this is what will give you things like the horizon being a null surface. It's because of this type of property. You'll get these generators for your structure. Now, here's our first sort of global definition. It's a Cauchy horizon. And we've seen already an example of this, and we'll come back to that. And so what we have here is the Cauchy. This will be our future Cauchy horizon. Again, we'll have our past and our whole Cauchy horizon. And what we do here is we take the domain of dependence. So we look at all these causal curves that intersect the Cauchy slice. We take the closure of that to include any limit points. And then we take the chronological past of the original set. We subtract that out. Okay, and this will be our Cauchy horizon. And you can define this is future Cauchy horizon. Again, we'll have this as a definition. We'll see an example, but when we do the more explicit examples, we'll apply these. So here's an example of a Cauchy horizon. So if you go over here, what are we going to do? We're going to look here. We're going to take the domain of dependence, future domain of dependence, and take its closure. So when we go to this diagram, the future domain of dependence will go this way because we're just assuming increasing t is the future. We can make the other choice too if you like, but this for this my particular setup. And then what I have here is the little white lines represent my light cone. So that gives me my local causal structure. And if I look at it, what do I get for the future domain of dependence? It's all the region of this cone to the future of it. As I take all these, if I take any point in here and send the causal curves out, each one of those will strike the surface. And so D plus of this surface S is everything inside here. Now when I take the closure of that, I'll include the boundary of it. Then what I'll do is I'll go back and see, wait, now what do I need to do? Now I take my D plus and I take all the curves I take these other guys and I'm going to subtract those out. So what I'm left with is I'm left with this light cone here. That's my Cauchy horizon. And what does that make sense? Well, yeah, it makes sense because what's going to happen is that's what's prohibiting it. The evolution equations, if you work with these equations, they break down on the surface. You no longer can do the evolution of the problem, so it dies there. And so that's the Cauchy horizon. Now, I can derive this. I can try doing this from the equations, from the geometry. The disadvantage of doing that directly is if I'm not careful, I'm going to have a hard time telling the difference between a coordinate singularity and the actual singularity in the a non-coordinate, so this breakdown in the evolution. So this is why you need the global quantities. You need to ask when these things are good. Okay, so now let's look a little bit more. This guy here is a Minkowski space, and we got some causal structure on it, the basic light cone, and we have this little subspace, so this is a partial Cauchy slice. But let's look at this in a slightly different picture. And what I'm going to do here, again, I don't expect you to write this all down, but this is a standard little coordinate change you can do. And what we're doing here is we're changing the ranges. One of the things that happens, if you think of this diagram here, the really important thing is asking what the light cones do. It's not really how far the stuff is away. So one advantage you can have in doing the analysis is if you push everything into some finite region and study it there. If you think of the original first non-trivial manifolds I told you about the sphere with the stereographic projection. If I do the same thing here, except on the space-time, maybe I can learn things in a nicer way. If you think of the stereographic projection, the idea of points, functions, and things happening at infinity is very easy because it's the things which happen at the North Pole. So I want to do the same type of compactification here. So what I do is I look at the Minkowski metric written in spherical coordinates, and R and T actually have infinite ranges, and there's no way to draw that, right? So what I do is I do a coordinate transformation, and there's a couple steps skipped here. One of the things is I want to separate out how the rays go out towards in the null direction, and the time-like direction, and space-like. I want to sort of look at all those different directions. So I'm using basically a retarded type null coordinate system. And the tangent here is actually doing, along with the other trig function here, does some of my compactification. So if I do this coordinatization, I can rewrite the metric in this following form. And I now have this conformal transformation. So if you remember one thing about the conformal transformation, if I look at null vectors, any null vectors, and I take their dot product or evaluate the metric on there, I preserve angles with this conformal transformation. And so the angles are preserved, the distances aren't. And so that's how I'll capture the causal structure in this. And so here's some sort of different colors here so you can see things. So what I've written as I've redrawn Minkowski space, but now in spherical coordinates or polar coordinates, and I've suppressed actually two of the dimensions here. If you want, you could actually draw this same picture as like a cone sitting on the floor here as the future in the end. You can think of it like a cone, or you could do it, you know, with one dimension suppressed. But it's easier just to draw it two-dimensional. I'll show you the diagram you get and then talk about the other one. So if you look at, if you just look at Minkowski space and you think of time-like curves, just the observers sitting in the room not doing anything, then they go off to this direction. If you have light signals going off, they're going to go at a null direction. They go out this way, and the null light signals coming in come in like this. So it's sort of a natural, that's the natural split I'm talking about in doing this breakup. So here, this thing's going in this direction, it'll be time-like infinity, past and future. This will be null, and this is the obvious. If I take my Cauchy slice with t equals zero, this is my spatial infinity. And these two are actually related by the conformal transformation. And you can actually relate this to the Einstein, it's a region of the Einstein static universe. And again, this is this comment where if you know some of the killing vectors in one metric, you can actually determine them in the other. And we'll sort of see how that works. Now, after doing my compactification, this is what I get. So I've actually pushed everything into a compact region. And so now my time-like curves, they actually, instead of going straight, since I'm pushing in, they actually do get bent a bit. Now, these are the constant time-like curves we had in the previous picture after re-coordinatizing. Here's non-geodesic time-like curves. So if you have a non-geodesic one, these are the free-falling geodesics. Everybody just sitting in the room here. These are the non, they'll actually hit scry plus, scry minus. Scry plus and scry minus are used to talk about the future null and past null infinity. I0 represents the spatial infinity. If you take your Cauchy slice going out this way, that's taking large R values, so you're actually going out that way. And here's some other curves that sort of come in. This is R equals 0. Now, you can also represent this if you want one extra dimension to be visualized. You could represent this by a cone sitting here, and then you have another cone on the bottom. So you have two cones. Or another way to say it is you can just rotate this about this vertical axis here. That will give you another dimension to visualize. It doesn't help in most cases, but that just gives you some additional structure. So each point in this picture is represented by a two-sphere, represents a two-sphere. And the reason we can actually do this, just as a side remark, It's because of the spherical symmetry of the metric. That is, the metric only depends on, there's only this R dependence. This is sort of just sitting there. So whenever you have a spherical metric, spherically symmetric metric, and you do the Penrose diagram, this is usually called the Penrose diagram, what you can do is you can throw away that those extra dimensions, because all the behavior is determined by the T and R coordinate and the geodesics. And as I said here, you get the future and past are described by the future infinities and all geodesics and so forth. And you can also look at these radially directed photons. These are the photons coming in. You follow these guys in. They're my little dotted ones there. Now, you can also do the Schwarzschild case the same way. And this one actually has more structure in that it has a coordinate. Now, I guess the next speaker is in 5 minutes, so this is probably a good place to stop to give some time for change. And so what we'll then look ahead to is we'll actually do the other, sort of some of the other known examples. And once you have these space-time diagrams, so we can skip ahead, this is what we'll get, just jumping a little bit ahead. This is the kind of diagram you'll actually get for Schwarzschild. This is going to have a lot more structure in it. And it'll also be regions which are hidden. There are regions which you cannot probe by your geodesics. So as a little exercise you can think of is, can you make the similar diagram for Rindler space? Or maybe the other one of the other examples. So Rindler space would be the accelerated observers in Minkowski. You know, can you get the same kind of structure? You're not going to get these singularities there, but you'll still get horizons appearing. So this is a good place to stop. So the next lecture will analyze the causal structure here and start looking, putting on the quantum fields on these and asking what happens then. Okay. We go on to the next stuff. So we'll be assuming a lot of the definitions when we talk about, you know, we'll assume causal definitions of Cauchy horizon and stuff when we do the field theory calculation. Yeah?
Yeah, I may be going to embarrass myself, but if you have a Cauchy surface, are you able to think that you then have a whole foliation of
theorizing? Yeah, if you have a Cauchy surface, you foliate the guy up. Okay. You get this whole... Sorry? If you have a Cauchy slice, you always foliate it up. The only problem, of course, is when you do Reichstein-Nordström, because if you think ahead or that, where you get these extra powers, it doesn't. The Cauchy slice doesn't seem to give you all of that. And what that's being caused by, that's because you're extending the space-time beyond that Cauchy horizon. So it's just like the Minkowski space, where you only have really a partial Cauchy slice for the whole extension. And again, that will cause the field theory to behave differently. Yeah. Any other? Yeah.
I didn't catch what the metric was for space.
Yeah. Okay. So you can actually. I didn't give that one explicitly, but what it is accelerated rocket ship. So you just coordinatize and use the acceleration as your one of your coordinates. So you just do the boost. So you rewrite the constant. So it's hyperbolic sine, hyperbolic cosh. With acceleration and the proper time. So your time coordinate's the proper time of the rocket ship, and the spatial coordinate is the acceleration, or 1/acceleration. It's sort of dark, I thought. What I'll do is I'll make the notes. I'll see about getting them printed off and like passing them out before the next lecture. I guess the next lecture will be Wednesday, right? Bullshit. Or you don't know yet, but yeah, so at some point we'll... Any other...
You said that if you find that stress energy tensor violates the energy conditions of functional systems, could you say a little more about that?
Yeah, so one of the things that happens is the stress energy tensor, so ANIC is sort of an averaging of the energy conditions, and you can do the same thing for any of the others. So for example, there was a big industry of time machines where people looked at time machines, and the way they produced them was to actually construct a space-time that had the behavior they wanted and then said that the matter source was whatever the geometry gave you by putting it through. Okay, the problem is that when people did field theory calculations, for example, in two-dimension quantum field theory. So when you do quantum field theory calculations, there's no 2D field theories that violate the anechoic energy condition. And then there's actually some more recent work done by Wald and one of his students where they looked at violations, and if you put stuff back in, the only violations could happen at Planck scales where the theory is actually breaking down. There's also something called the quantum interest conjecture that tells, it's not proven yet, but in all the cases done, if you actually have small violations, if you violate the energy conditions, you have to pay back with interest. And so the field theory sort of conspires. If you have any conformally invariant theory, then you sort of get away with the conformally invariant theories tend not to violate the energy conditions. That's why the 2D case actually works.
Normally, hyperbolic space is one that the evolution path and from a Cauchy surface gives you the whole space.
That's right. Now, there's the caveats on that are it's how you think of the how you think of that cut of Minkowski space where I took the mass hyperboloid. If I take my whole space time to be that region, the domain of dependence, which is only part of Minkowski, then it's true. But if I want to extend it beyond that Cauchy horizon, then I get more space time.
Definition should hold for every Cauchy hypersurface, or are there spaces where, depending on what Cauchy hypersurface you start with, you obtain the whole space?
Yeah, so if you take a partial Cauchy slice, you'll get part of the space, and if you take a Cauchy slice, you'll get the whole space. So one of the examples will be like Rindler, or the other example, my cone. Rindler is just you turn that cone sideways on the spatial axis, and what will happen is there's a piece missing, because you only have like a partial, you only have partly done the space-time.
I mean, the same space where you have two different Cauchy hypersurfaces.
Yep. You have two different Cauchy, as long as they're Cauchy, they have to be the same and you'll get the same space. So it's a unique evolution then. But typically what happens in examples is we get more because we extend it beyond, and that's where we'll get the particle creation and temperatures and things. Any other one? Okay. So...